I'm Storm Lawson. I'm a happy alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I want to thank the committee for inviting us down to speak this weekend. It's one of the ways we stay sober, so they're helping us stay sober another day. And I want to thank Stan and Robin for going out of their way to make us very comfortable this weekend. It's been great. And you know, if I qualify to be here, I sometimes wonder why I qualify to make an AA talk. And I feel it's because I'm a real alcoholic that's found a substitute for alcohol. And I didn't know that's what I was looking for when I got here. But to make that substitute work, I had to do some things. I had to get a home group. Incidentally, my home group is a traditional group in Greenville, South Carolina. We meet on Tuesdays and Fridays. We have an equal number of discussion meetings about the steps on Friday night, and on we have a speakers meeting on Tuesday night. All these meetings start at 8 o'clock, and we'd love to have you come visit us if you're in the Greenville area. I also had to get a sponsor. And I had to go through these steps and find out what the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous were and try to apply them to the best of my ability in my life. And I've done that, and because I did that, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since September the 25th, 1973. Now, you know, I tried to, in hunting for this substitute, I tried a lot of things to fix me, so it's with a lot of pleasure that I tell you this morning that since that same date in 1973, I haven't found it necessary to be analyzed, tranquilized, hypnotized, or baptized. You see, I'm one of the fortunate ones. Alcoholics Anonymous has done the whole deal for me. You know, we hear today a whole lot about problems other than alcohol. Well, man, I had problems other than alcohol from the very get-go. You see, I'm not only an alcoholic, but I'm a hillbilly. And I was born right in the middle of the Depression, the only son of a mountain school teacher, and they named me Sterling Fletcher Watts III. I don't think I had a chance from the start. And you see, I had, all these years, I never had any identity till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Mama taught school for 40 years, so everywhere I went the first 18 or 19 years of my life, I was known as Miss Kitty's little boy. And when I was 19, I went across the river and married a prominent farmer's daughter, and overnight I became Mac Jackson's son-in-law. And I came down to Greenville, South Carolina, to get away from all that, and I had one son who was quite a football player. He was All-State, Shrine Bowl, played at Clemson. I got down there, and I became Waldo's daddy. And I tell you that because, you know, a lot of people get into AA a lot of different ways, and I know a lot of people from Conway and Brooklyn and Los Angeles and different places just came up and said, hey, I've been drinking, I'm tired, and I want to come in, work steps, and get spiritual. I didn't get here that way. I had a heck of a lot of help. I had help from bosses, I had help from judges and state troopers and doctors, but the main help I had was from Al-Anon. In fact, I say I came into the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous when I became powerless over Al-Anon. You see? You see, she'd been going to Al-Anon several months before I got here, and I tell you this, you know, do you remember the first time they ever asked you to read? They asked me to read How It Works. Man, I went back in the restroom and studied. I was ready for this night, and I'm sitting there on the front row, and they said in to read How It Works, and they forgot my name and said Nancy's husband. So, so you see, when I finally got to stand up here and say I'm Sterling Watts, man, I thought I'd arrived, you know, but, and also, you know, I was a liar. I think I was born to liar. I probably learned to lie when I started to talk, and I was a little bit different kind of a liar. I was the kind of liar that would tell you a lie, and I didn't leave it at that, because the thrill I got out of it was knowing that I'd made you believe it. And I'd hang around, if necessary, tell another one or two till I got you hooked, you know. For instance, this was a very religious home that I was raised in. I sometimes think maybe that's a launching pad for alcoholism. I don't know. I hear a lot of it. But if we were going to eat on Sunday, we had to memorize Bible verses and recite them before each meal. And I was capable of memorizing Bible verses, but I took a lot of thrill in making them up. And I remember one that I made up was, if a man goeth on a long journey and returneth not, he stayeth a long while. Now, yeah. Now, what I really liked about that was, over late at night, I'd see the old folks thumbing through that Bible trying to find that verse a little tyke had picked up on. That made me feel warm all over, you know. Now, in this family of mine, I have one sister, 5 years older than I. You know, there are only two perfect people ever walked the face of this earth, and she was one of them. She never told a lie. She never came home late. She never did anything to disturb anybody. She's just a perfect person. She made straight A's all through school, valedictorian in high school, dean's list in college, the whole bit. And somewhere along the line, it looked like, you know, I loved attention. And only way she'd cornered the market on being good. There's no way I could compete with that. So I think I started out trying to corner the market on being bad. But it started right away. I got used to, why can't you be like Elizabeth? And you know, I remember they used to tell me, say, well, when you get her age, you can do so-and-so. And as a little tyke, that excited me. I realized later I was never going to get to be her age. She's always 5 years older than me, you know. Well, in this family unit, everybody had an idea of what they wanted from me. My mama wanted me to be a Methodist preacher. Bless her heart, she prayed for that, I think, till the day she died. My daddy wanted me to be a great trial lawyer. And my sister just wanted me to go away, you know how that is. And nobody ever asked me what I wanted. And what I wanted, I think, is pretty indicative of my thinking and my aspiration in life. We had a fellow there named R.L. Now, R.L. was he was my age, but he seemed much older and wiser. He lived by himself with his daddy, and his daddy stayed drunk all the time. I know now his mother had to leave home, but R.L. didn't have any parental guidance. He could do anything he wanted to. He could go swimming anytime he wanted to. He could go naked anytime he wanted. Naked swimming anytime he wanted to. He could cuss better than anybody I ever heard, and probably knew more about sex than Dr. Ruth, you know. And this really intrigued me. But the main thing about him, he had no rules to follow. He didn't even have to take a bath unless he wanted to. And I loved R.L. I loved the way he smelled. He had that gusto, you know. And as a kid, everywhere I went, it seemed like to me I smelled like Lifebuoy soap, you know. But anyway, that was my aspiration, to be just like R.L. This didn't work too well in the family situation that I was in. I can remember probably the first serious prayer I ever remember praying, that Mama'd get drunk, Daddy'd get drunk, Mama'd leave home so I could live like R.L. You know, now today, some things don't always change. Today, we'll go on vacation, and after about 4 days, I like to lay around and not shave and not shower, and Donald say, I believe R.L.'s come to see us, you know. So. Well, now, drinking as a teenager was not a problem. I know the kind of, I tasted it and one thing and another, but I just had too close a supervision. I couldn't drink, and shortly after graduating from high school, I went 55 miles an hour away from home to be inducted into service, and that was the first night that I'd ever been away from home that far without adult supervision. And that night I got sick and I got drunk and I almost died. And that was in September of 1946. 27 years later, in September of 1973, three states away, I'm still getting drunk, still getting sick, and still almost dying. So there's a certain amount of insanity that goes along with this disease of alcoholism. And, you know, I did not realize it, but as I look back over my life, I changed. I changed jobs. I changed situations. I changed locations. I did everything I could to protect my alcoholism, and I didn't know that was happening at that time. And I had three things that, right from the very start in drinking, that I know today shows that I was just as alcoholic at 17 and 18 as I was the day I quit. Now, I've got to tell you, I was a sick drunk, and sick drunks are not popular. You know, you don't invite them over to look at your new carpet, I started... When I first started making my AA talks, I was talking about this sickness, and my Al-Anon said, look, do I have to put up with that kind of... Can't you leave that out? Said, I've cleaned enough of that stuff up. I don't want to hear about it anymore. And I developed a word. I said, I unswallowed a lot. So, and she accepted that, and it sounds pretty neat, but it still hurt the same way. But anyhow, you know, I can remember I had a friend in 1956 that got the prettiest Pontiac automobile I'd ever seen. It to that either today it was silver and gray and had pretty gray interior. And we were working the third shift. We got off that morning and we were riding down the road and I started rolling the window down. He said, my reputation had preceded me. He said, not in here you don't. And so he put me out so I could unswaller. And I put my hands on top of the car and unswallered back in the window. And now, you see, I had blackouts, and I had sore eyeballs. I had the sorest eyeballs of any mortal you ever saw. I can remember laying on my back sometimes the morning after, and I'd go by, and I'd move my eyeballs, and it would hurt me all the way to my hip pocket. It just killed me. And I had blackouts, and I had these blackouts, and if you're a blackout drinker, you know the difference between blacking out and passing out. I'd go two or three days and really not just come to, and I'd come to on Monday and not remember anything since Friday. And I spent a good bit of time backtracking then, trying to see, and some things I could remember a little bit of. But I remember those first blackouts very vividly. Later on, they followed me. But later on, I just learned to accept them as part of the a normal life, I guess. But I look back on these things, and I knew, see, this sickness, it was causing me some trouble, embarrassment, people having all kind of problems with it. And my daddy had an ulcer. And I had two uncles that had nervous stomachs. So I figured how unfortunate I was that I'd inherited this stomach condition from my daddy's side of the family. Now, my mother had a thyroid condition, and she had slightly protruding eyes. And I assumed I'd inherited these awful eyeballs from my mother's side of the family. Blackouts, I didn't address it. Nobody ever asked me if I blacked out. So I assumed if you drank, you blacked out. And I just accepted this. And with this great knowledge, I came back from service in 1948 and started out on a normal career. If there was any normal drinking, I don't know what normal is about normal drinking, but if there ever was such a thing in my life, it was from 48 to 62. I had a little lady out in Texas. I spoke out in Texas, and when it was over, she said, well, I know what normal is. So that's a sitting on a washing machine. So that's about as much as I know about normal. But I got back from service, and industry had moved into the mountains while I was gone, and I got a job on the ground floor in the textile industry, and things went fine. I worked hard and got promotions, and I married my childhood sweetheart. A year later, our only son came along, and I seemed to be rather popular in the neighborhood. I belonged to everything there was there, the Elks, the Kiwanis, the JCs, the Moose, the VFW, the disabled veterans, anything. I'd join anything that had me, it looked like, and the reason. But when I take a look back at that, most of those places served whiskey, and I lived in a dry county. And I think that must have had a lot to do with it. I was also active in church. I was superintendent of Sunday school of the largest Methodist church in Pulaski, Virginia for a period of 4 years. So things looked normal. A group of us in 1954, a group of young men got together, and we bought a piece of land, and we all built homes out there like everybody was doing after World War II. It just seemed like it was real good. But when I got and had to look at my four-step, and I looked back during that period of time, for instance, I was in five or six automobiles that were totally lost. Sometimes I was driving, sometimes I was riding. Most of the time we had no idea who's driving, who's riding, you know. And one day, Thanksgiving Day one year, I had three accidents in the same day. And that day I hit the same man twice. Now, and you know, I just didn't hit him over in the parking lot later on that same morning. I got him way over in the afternoon, 15 miles away from where I'd hit him that morning. And in those days, you just called your insurance company and reported these accidents, and I called mine, and he said, Watts, how drunk are you? You reported that accident this morning. I said, man, I'm not drunk. I've hit him again, you know. Gee. Give me a break, you know. Well, now, I'm not handy with tools. I don't know a screwdriver from a pair of pliers, and I don't know a hammer from anything else. I'm just not handy, and I don't do yard work. I'm just not handy. I don't have a green thumb. I don't care about that. In fact, I never did anything that got you to any points with the lady folks. I like to hunt and fish and shoot pool and gamble and play cards and play golf and all that kind of stuff. And so right out, you know, I told you we bought this tract of land and all, we were going to have these turnkey houses. Well, all my life it's been, why can't you be like Elizabeth? It started when I was just a kid. And right after we got married, it was, why can't you be like Jim and Tom and Bill? Because everybody could fix things, handyman, had pretty yards. If I were to move into your yard in your neighborhood tomorrow, I'd look out the window, and right across the street would be a sign that said Yard of the Month. And all I ever got was wild onion of the decade, you know. So instead of being turnkey houses, these handymen started goofing things up. They started putting in their gutters or their furnace or their cabinets, all of them doing something, pouring their concrete. I'm not doing anything, don't intend to, but that's when I think I first felt impending doom. She's looking at me, and I know she's going to pounce sooner or later and won't know why I'm not doing something. And she'd gone up to her dad's on the 4th of July, and it dawned on me, one of those real alcoholic thoughts, that nobody on that street had put in their mailbox yet. And so now, by this time, an interesting thing had happened in my life as I look back. I used liquor to control things, and mainly I controlled things I didn't like. Any job that I didn't like or didn't want to do, or any person I didn't want to face, I had subconsciously signed a certain amount of liquor to it. For instance, if I was going to paint, that was a court job. I was the kind of painter that got the liquor, and then I got to paint in the drop cloth. And then by that time, I had to get the liquor again, you know, but if I had to work in the yard, that took probably a case of beer, a pint, or... And I had this sister. We didn't get along. I called her my two-pint sister, you know. So I don't know. I really don't know how much booze I assigned to this mailbox job, but I assume, knowing me right much, it's interesting how this mailbox came about. I went down to the engineer, the head engineer at my company, and we got a 2-inch pipe, 8 feet in diameter, and down in that, we put another 8-foot pipe, an inch and a half, and we spot welded them all the way up, and I came back up to my house and went down to Sears and got the biggest mailbox I had and put Sterling Fletcher Watts III on it. Just let it flow. It was beautiful. And I came back and I dug this 4-foot hole and put in steel reinforced concrete, put that boy in there and tamped it well. And, you know, I don't know whether you all have done this or not, but when you work hard all day and it's hot and you drink all day, only an alcoholic knows you just before you go into that peaceful slumber, you know. I thought, gosh, she's going to be proud of me tomorrow when she comes home. Next morning about 6 o'clock, my phone rang. My neighbor. He said, Watch, what the hell is wrong with you yesterday? I said, what do you mean? He said, you got that mailbox in facing your house. Now. And it's hot 4th of July, about 100 degrees, and I got about 45 minutes or an hour to get that boy turned up and turned around, and I'm unswallowing and digging and pushing. And when I got through, it looked like you'd build a swimming pool and filled it in, you know. And another thing beginning to happen in our life here is, I was a tavern drinker, and I love to drink in the... I'd stop in a tavern and have a couple of beers, and they'd have to throw me out when they closed. I just could lose time when I got in those dark places. I loved the beautiful ladies that came there to dance, to the good country music and the tear-jerking songs, and I loved the shuffleboard. I mean, it was just paradise, and I could get in there, and I had no idea what time it was or anything else, and it was just wonderful. And my wife hated every ounce of anything that went along with drinking. She hated. So you can see that everything I liked, she hated. And this marriage is just not getting along too good. In fact, along about this time, we developed a situation that I later referred to as a chemical muscular reaction. When I bent my muscle to take a chemical, her mouth flew open. And I called that chin music. And that was the chinniest woman you ever saw in your life. I never got to drink in peace. And by this time, I'd worked my way up in my... I was superintendent of a couple of departments, and I bought all the machinery and all the chemicals, and these salesmen that called on me knew I loved to drink. So when they came to town, which we usually had one or two every week, they had plenty of booze, and we had a lot of fun. We did a lot of drinking, and it dawned on me. Hey, these guys, They leave home on Monday. They don't go back home till Friday. They got 5 full days and nights to drink with no chin music. I quit the very best job I probably ever had and came to South Carolina to sell chemicals. Now, I know that I came down there to drink. It's no question about it. They gave me a new automobile, and I'll never forget, this was a one-owner company, and the man lived resided up in Rhode Island, so he didn't have much control over me. But he said an interesting thing. He said, "The people in the textile industry in the South are not familiar with my company, and I want you to take this unlimited expense account and see that my name gets established." Well, don't get ahead of me. I know today that he meant in the textile industry where he had products to offer, but you know, state troopers, judges, jails, everybody got to know that company before I was finished with it. The first thing I did, I got a new Ford automobile. Up in Virginia where I came from, you could only haul a limited amount of booze in the car at one time. In South Carolina, you could haul all you could pay for. I put 2 cases of booze in the back of a new Ford automobile and ran up and down the road selling chemicals. Did real good because I had a couple of things wrong. I had the ability, if I could keep my alcohol level just right, I could go 2 or 3 days and not sleep. I could play golf all day, play cards all night, shower, go back and play cards all day, run a card game all night, and they loved that kind of thing. And they'd say things like, "Well, I'd rather ride with old Watchman. He's drunk, and I had Tom and him sober, and I'd just swell up and drink a pint and drive them anywhere they wanted to go." I loved that kind of thing. And, you know, somewhere along the line, when I got to you people now, I weighed about almost 289 pounds. It's the highest I think I ever got. And I was just full of the fluid that you've seen us. So somewhere along this time, I'm running up and down the road selling these chemicals. And I had one guy tell me what would happen. See, we didn't have bars and we didn't have mini bottles. We had brown bagging, and I'd pull in, raise the trunk of that car up, and we'd have a few drinks right there in the parking lot. Go around to the spring and have a few drinks, or down at the golf course or the fishing hole. Had one guy down in Abbeville said, "You called down here 18 months, and we weren't sure what you were selling." Said, "We thought you were a liquor salesman in the wrong place." And along about this time, somewhere along in here, the company had insisted that I take an insurance exam, and I just wasn't going. And I told you how heavy I was, but maybe that was the reason. But anyway, I finally had to go in rather than getting fired and have this insurance exam. And when I went in, I remember they took my blood pressure, and the nurse left, and I'm rolling my sleeves down, and here she comes back with this little cart of stuff, and I said, "What's that?" And she said, "That's oxygen." I said, "What's that for?" She said, "Well, you got your blood pressure is so high, you're in stroke zone." I said, "You could have a stroke any minute." I said, "Wait a minute. I just came in here feeling good, wanting to have an insurance exam. Now, if I'm that sick, shouldn't I have some kind of symptom? If my blood pressure's that high?" She said, "Well, usually you're dizzy." Well, now I'd been dizzy for a couple of years. And see, and I had things like seeing 3 bridges. I don't know whether y'all ever saw 3 bridges or not. I couldn't handle 3 bridges. I'd have to pull over and rest a while till I could get it down to 2, and then I could shut one eye and get across that bridge. And I was suspecting that booze might have something to do with this. Show you how sick I was. I came home tickled to death that drinking didn't have anything to do with it. It's just my blood pressure making me dizzy and giving me eye problems. And along about this time, my wife had noticed some peculiar behavior. She'd get in touch with everybody, and they'd get in touch with me. And finally, somebody from AA got in touch with me, and it shut her up. We went to some meetings. Now, I'm not sure where we went. We might even gone sometimes to the automobile club, because she's sicker than I was. But one of the guys we met along here was a guy named Squire Jones. He's dead now, and he was a tremendous member of Alcoholics Anonymous there in Greenville. And he wiry little old fella, and he'd say things to me after this. He'd see me in July, and I'd be hot and sweaty and weighed almost 300 pounds, and he'd say, "Why didn't you wait till it got colder to get drunk? You just wanted to kick him, you know." Well, and he'd said, "If you ever get ready, call me," and so one day the chin music got so bad I couldn't stand it, and I called Squire. I said, "Come on over here and talk to me. I'm ready." He got in his car and started to cross town. I got in my car and left town. And Now, Squire got over there, and he was kind of frugal, and he figured he'd spend his money, and he kind of 12-stepped Nancy. He told her a little bit about his story, and evidently she told him a little bit about mine, because what came out of all this was that she figured she'd got the idea that honey and orange juice would fix everything. You see, she had to tell him how bad I was shaking, and man, I was shaking. I was shaking so bad I could thread a sewing machine running wide open, and And Squire told her, said, well, to help these nerves and stuff, give him honey and orange juice and Cairo syrup and orange juice. So a ritual was I'd come home and she'd be standing there at this concoction and she'd shove about 3 tablespoons full of that honey down my throat, give me some of this concoction to drink, a half honey and half orange juice, and I'd get it down and I'd walk down the hall to where I had my vodka head. And by the time I got it out, I was so stuck together I couldn't hardly get a drink down, you know. Hey, we know that if you come into Alcoholics Anonymous and you go back out there, Alcoholics Anonymous will really mess up your drinking. You get, you know, there's not much worse than a head full of AA and a belly full of beer. But I'm going to tell you, that honey and orange juice don't do much for it either, I tell you. I was getting to be the sweetest drunk in the Southeast. Anyway, well, that didn't work for AA, wasn't working for me. You could tell that. So she didn't let that stop her. She found a fella that AA didn't work for him, but he'd had a job just like I had. And he'd gone to a psychiatrist, and he'd gotten all well. So he came over and talked to him, and off I went to my first of many trips to the psychiatrist. Now, that's a whole other two-hour story, and if you've never been there, they put that little hourglass up there, and you start talking, and when the sand runs through, session's over. Well, I didn't do it that way. I watched his eyes, and I could tell. I'd feed him a Miss Kitty story and watch his eyes, and when I had enough, I cut the session off. That's all he's going to get today, because I knew I was going to be there a long time. And I'd go home, and I'd get a half pint, and I'd sit down and tell Nancy how much progress we was making. You know, I look back on that today. That's one time I feel like I got conned. He was getting $70 an hour for that little game we was playing, you know. Well, anyway, he said an interesting thing. I think we could probably, most alcoholics I know drive a psychiatrist crazy if they really listen to us. But anyhow, he said the next time he acts up, and this is a funny thing, said the next time he acts up, I'll put him where he can be observed more closely. And so this was my first trip to that Marshall Pickens Donna was talking about, which is the hospital for the emotionally disturbed. Now, it's an interesting thing. I was over there 5 or 6 times. I've been over there in the back of a pickup truck. I've been over in the trunk of a car. I've been over in an ambulance, about any way you can get there, and every time I went, I was dog drunk. But you can look at my medical record over there, and it's drunk's not mentioned. It's hypertension, schizophrenia, just paranoia, depression. I guess for the prices they were charging, they didn't think drunk would look too good. But anyway, they never addressed anything to do with drinking, and I'll never forget the first time I was over. All of a sudden, I came to, and I'm in occupational therapy. Now, man, I'm telling you. You know, I told you, I'm not handy with tools or anything. I'm making these leather watch bands faster than anybody. They're pretty leather watch bands, too, and I could make three in 1 hour. And the next best person in there, it took them about all 3 or 4 hours to make one. I've never been so proud. I was popping. If they hadn't run out of leather, I'd still be over there. I can tell you that. And they had another thing over there called group therapy. And in my group, there was 19 women and me. And 17 of these women had had hysterectomies. Now, if you think alcoholics got problems, you ain't heard nothing, I'm telling you. And all of a sudden, it dawns on me what I'm doing over there. You see, my drinking's not bothering me. It's driving Nancy crazy. It's just driving her crazy. She's worrying herself to death about it. And so it just made sense to me that what they were telling me was that I was not as good a provider as I thought I was because she had a place to live and food to eat and a car to drive, that I should provide her with one of these operations she'd have enough to worry about and I'd never have to be bothered again. I got out of that hospital feeling good, went straight home, sat her down, and we discussed what she was supposed to do. She wasn't willing to go to any lengths, I can tell you that. But now, we We had another thing in that. If you'd been an ideal client, they called us, if you'd been an ideal client all week, you got a reward on Saturday. You got to go on a field trip. Now, a field trip consisted of gathering up in the lobby, and they gave you a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and you got to hike over to Kmart. And I'm standing there with our little group. Now, you got to remember that all these people, most of these ladies were taking shock treatments, and they're very nervous. And they all smoked. But they couldn't be trusted with matches. I got the matches, and if any one of them wanted to smoke while we was on that field trip, they had to come and see me. And I can remember walking out of there thinking they really recognized my leadership ability. I kind of felt like I was in officer's training school. And you know how sick I was. I was out of there a year before I realized what had actually happened. That I was 44 years old and I'd worked myself up to the keeper of a matches in a nut house as well. Well, I got home, and now, you know, it's wonderful, and thank y'all for laughing with me, because I had to learn to laugh at myself before I could start to recover. See, all these are things I thought I'd never tell anybody, but, you know, I got out of there, and I went home, and you alcoholics know I'm running out of things to do. I'm trying everything, and nothing's working, and I'm getting sicker and sicker, and she said, well, you haven't tried to be rehabilitated. Well, we didn't want to miss anything, so off I went to Palmetto Center, which is a state rehabilitation center up here at Florence, and I tell you, when I got there, I got the biggest resentment I ever had in my life, right the very first day. Now, I didn't know what a resentment was then, but I got madder than the Dickens, because everybody there was a ward of the state except me. They were getting free treatment. 28 days, it was going to cost me $600. Now, I had a job, but I didn't have any insurance, so the $600 was going to come out of my pocket, and I was the only one out of about 30 paying. And we had a doctor, and he just locked his doors, no practice. He was getting free treatment. So I had an awful resentment. Now, this starts where I think God started making an impression on me and working with me, my alcoholism, and I'll tie it all back in together. So let's remember the $600 that I was so mad about. They said, well, you can go over to Alcoholics Anonymous. They come on Thursday if you wish to. We don't recommend it or not recommend it. We provide a place for them to come in and talk to you. You can go if you want to. I had nowhere else to go, I guess, and I went. Now, what I heard and saw over there is indicative of what was going on in my mind. I thought y'all were the sickest bunch of people that ever been. People would drive 50 miles, as I saw it, to tell me their problems, and I'm so sick that I'm being down there paying $600 for rehabilitation. And what made me think that they were telling me their problems, there was a young man there that looked like he wasn't a day over 30 years old, and he stood behind the podium in front of us and said he couldn't take one drink without getting drunk. Never felt sorry for anybody in my life. My God, can you imagine? Drunk, you know. And well, I knew he was at big problems that I could help him solve. And so I wrote his name down. I was going to look him up. I was always good-hearted. But this particular time, you see, I knew from what I knew about drinking, if I could get him and I could keep him paying, I believe I could keep him going for 3 weeks anyhow, you know. So I got ready to leave down there, and they told me an interesting thing. They said, go back to Greenville and don't drink, and we think you'll be all right. Now, I began to suspect this, but I had no way of knowing. I tried a lot of things. I couldn't quit drinking. I didn't know how to do it, not drink. But by gum, I was going to try, because they charged me $600, and this, I was going to do everything they told me to do, and I'd prove to them it wouldn't work, and I'd sue them and get my $600 back. So I went home, and I didn't drink for 5 or 6 months, just like they told me. Now, I'm living proof of what happens to a real alcoholic of my type when you take alcohol out and put nothing in. I was miserable, the most miserable 6 or 7 months, whatever it was, that I ever spent. I hated everybody, and I hated everything. I got a glass about this big, and I filled it full of iced tea, and everywhere I went, I said, hey, look at me. I'm 44 years old and can never drink again. I said things like, let's get our milk and cookies and go to bed, you know. I thought my manhood was gone. I thought everything you did that was fun in life was gone. So I hated you if you could not drink and be happy, and I hated you if you could drink and not get in trouble. And I just hated everybody. And had I not gotten drunk, I'd have committed suicide. I had a choice and I got drunk. And that started a period of several months of when I drank what I referred to as zombolically. I was just a zombie. I didn't know what I was doing or where I was going or anything else. It attacked me with a vengeance. And right quickly, I'd come to holding the steering wheel. And I'd look down. And if I'd unswallowed all over myself, I knew I was coming home. If I was nice and clean like I am this morning, I knew I was going out. I didn't know where. And I'd drive around the corner, check in the motel, and have a few drinks just to let everything clear in my head so I can find out where I'm supposed to be and put everything in perceptive. And you know, the rat race started all over again. I'd have things on in my particular sales job. I'd see my clients once, maybe take them to lunch, and I'd call and say, "Can I come over tomorrow for lunch?" They'd say, "Well, fool, you was over here yesterday." And or I'd say, they'd call and say, "This is Tom. Where's my sample?" I had no idea who Tom was or where his sample was. I just was operating like a zombie. And I came back from Augusta, Georgia sometime in September of 73, and I think I came home to die. And I went back in what Nancy referred to as my rat hole. We're not sure how long I stayed back there, because by this time she had developed a habit of going to visit relatives. She didn't have any, but she went somewhere, and the neighbor thought she was going to visit relatives. But anyway, I remember that coming to this night, I never want to forget it. I've been laying back there several days in a drunken liar, and you know the smell and the stench and the clamminess and the sweat and all of the mess I'm surrounded in. And I can hardly stand up. I have to crawl to the bathroom, and I'm in serious trouble. But the main thing that's wrong is when I can get a drink down, it does absolutely nothing. Liquor didn't work anymore, and I didn't know what to do. I just dropped my head over my hands, and I said, "My God, nobody knows." She's standing there, and she said, "Yeah, somebody knows, AA knows." And somehow she got me dressed that night, and we went to an AA meeting. I don't remember what all went together in that, what all went on in that AA meeting, but I remember one thing. I think that's the only time that I got a little bit honest with me, the first time I ever got honest with me about my drinking. Because on the way home, she said, "You didn't take a white chip, a desire chip." I said, "No, I'm too sick. I'm too sick. If I don't get a drink down tonight, I'm going to die." And see, before that, I told you, we went to some AA meetings, and always Squire, somebody would take me to an AA meeting. We'd go in, we'd have coffee and a cookie and whatever, and we'd sit there, and they'd give out chips, and he'd punch me, and I'd jump up and get one. If he'd have punched six times, I'd have gone right through the medallion. I didn't care. But this night, I got a little bit serious, I think. And so I did get a drink down sometime that night. I'm not sure when, but that was on the 23rd. Now, this is an interesting thing that happened in my life, and it's very important to me. I wait 2 days. As sick as I was, and I don't know other than God's grace or why, I wait 2 days to celebrate my dry date. I don't celebrate till the 25th. And there's all kind of strong evidence that I didn't have a drink after the 23rd. But I don't know why I did that. Didn't realize I'd done that till the end of the year. And I think that God knew that an alcoholic of my type, if I thought that I could stay around here any length of time and have maybe a dishonest dry date and you not pick up on it, I'd lose respect for you and probably drink again. But for whatever reason, and that's pretty, to me it's important. And I can only tell you this, since that day in September of 73, my life has never been the same again. I absolutely had no idea that a human being could stand before you this morning as happy and joyous and free as I am. And when I say free, I'm free that there's nothing about my life that's not an open book. There's nothing that I know of standing right here this morning that I have not discussed with God as I understand Him and another human being. And that gives me the ability to sleep at night. I don't have to worry about who's at the front door or who's going to knock on the door. Or I don't have any stress at night. If a telephone rings, I don't have to jump. And I owe all that to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a great way to live. I never knew that freedom to live without having to backtrack and wonder what I told you the last time I met you. The freedom from the dishonesty of lying is a total new way of life to me. And then the other thing that I've experienced here is that I can be myself and you will accept me. I don't have to put on a facade. I don't have to be anything but just me. And some of you are going to like me more than others. Some of you aren't going to like me. But you're all going to love me as an alcoholic. And that That love is what's kept me going these many years, and for AA I'll always be grateful for that. Now I'm living proof that you don't have to do it. If there's anybody here starting on this journey, you don't get discouraged if you're not doing everything they told you exactly the way they told you. I didn't do that. I'm living proof that you don't have to do everything they told you, and you can still make it in this fellowship. You will notice as I recant a little bit of this to you, I did one thing. I always went to meetings. I went to meetings every night, and that's the only thing that saved me. You said, you see, you had to have a desire to stay sober. I didn't have a desire to stay sober or stop drinking. I had a desire to learn how to drink, not to swallow, get in trouble with state troopers, or have to listen to chin music. And I figured I could sit in here with the professionals and find out how. You said, get a sponsor. Now, the way I got a sponsor is indicative of what I thought. There was an old man there that I'd talked to, or really related to. He was a hard, two-fisted drinker, been in the CBs, and he said he'd been sober 29 years. I knew he couldn't. He wasn't. And I knew if he could tell you that kind of lie and make you believe it, I wanted what he had. And so we started running together, and the old man couldn't see to drive at night, and I drove him everywhere he went. And we'd get out of town, and he'd speak, and they'd pick up chips. And if anybody picked up a beginner's chip or a 3 month chip or a month's chip, I'd go up after the meeting and put my arm around him. I'd say, man, this thing really works. Between me and that speaker, we got almost 30 years in this thing, you know. Now, I don't know whether they did this when you got here. I hope they don't do it at your home group now. But back then, sometimes they'd say, is there anybody got anything that's bothering their sobriety? Anybody got anything that's troubling they want to talk about? And with my keen mind, I noticed one thing. The more trouble you had, the more love you got. You said my house burned down, and my mother-in-law's come to live with me, or, you know, I'm sick, or somebody in the family died. After the meeting, they all gathered around you and gave you all kind of love. Another fella came in and said, man, I got this thing made. I got a new job, got a promotion, bought a new Cadillac, and go take my wife and go to Hawaii. They say, watch him. He may take a drink, you know. So I wanted the love. And I can remember I had some of the most God-awful stories you all ever heard, and they'd spend a whole hour talking about them and counseling me at the meetings, and I just swell up. My ego was getting big enough that I control the whole meeting. They talked about my problem, you know. And so one night, I tell you this, because one night I'm out in the yard before the meeting, and I've got about 8 guys standing there, and I'm telling them this awful story, and I got their attention. If you're a con man, you can tell by their eyes, and I had them in the palm of my hand, and I'm laying it on them, and they're all spellbound, and somebody taps me on the shoulder, and it's my sponsor. He said, are you praying like I told you? And I said, yes, sir. He said, you're a damn liar. Now, he'd insulted me in front of probably the best audience I'd had since I got an Alcoholics Anonymous. And plus, it wasn't none of his business anyway. He didn't know what was going on between me and my higher power. And I got mad at that old man. I don't even think I stayed for the meeting. I jumped in my car and I went home. And that the first AA prayer that I remember praying is I prayed that old man would get drunk and I'd get to give him his white chip. And now, like I say, I kept going to meetings, and while the home group is so important to me, we had an old woman there named Kate Taylor. Now, Taylor is one, I hope you've got one in your group. We got one in ours now. She knew the answers to questions I never had asked her. And she, you know, she's one of these that give you a number, say, now, honey, before you take a drink, you call me. And I'd say, you gave me that number Tuesday. Well, take it again, honey. You may have lost it. Take my number. Well, I came in one day. I'd been out on the road traveling, and things weren't too good at home. I'd already called, and I stopped out on the interstate, and I called Taylor, and I said, identified myself, and I said, you told me to call you, and I'm calling you, and I've had a bad week. My wife's mad at me at home, and I got 7 liquor stores to pass before I get home. Now, what you want me to do? And she thought a minute, and she said, go out in the median and strip off naked and stand there till they take you to jail. Now, I hung that phone up. I said, that old woman's crazy, you know. I went right by every one of those liquor stores, too. Now, today, I know what brought that about. See, I'd been going to that same home group And I'd been sharing all those 9 months, and Taylor'd been sitting right there, and thank goodness she'd been there. And she knew what I was trying to do, what I'd done all my life. I'd look at a set of rules, and I would try to circumvent them. I'd try to find something that the rules didn't cover, where I had a special situation to get around the rules. It was a thrill to me. I can remember in school, I could remember that if you talked, you disturbed me when I was trying to study. But if I had something to say, I could say it, and it shouldn't bother you. I've never understood me, but this... And she picked up on the fact that I was just looking for a situation you all didn't have covered. I could say, you didn't know what to tell me, and I got drunk, and I'd be thankful for that all along. Now, I also was a slip planner. I don't know whether y'all ever planned any slips or not, but I was a slip planner. I remember one night I'm sitting on the front seat, and I got a mug of beer right up on my head. I could see it, and the frost is coming down off of it. I'm not listening to what the speaker says or anything. And I'm planning what I'm going to do the next day. My car needed serviced, and I'm going to take my car and take it down to Sears, and while they're servicing this, I'm going around the corner because they serve the coldest beer in Greenville. Now, after that meeting was over that night, I met a guy named Charlie Brown from Chattanooga, Tennessee. I call his name because I've never met him since before or since. He was a salesman as I was, and we shared a little bit, and I got in my car and went home. The next morning, this was not a home group meeting. This was a meeting I didn't even plan on going to. Just happened to go. I went down to Sears, they ran my car up on the rack, and I turned and started that beer joint, and there stood Charlie Brown. He started talking to me about program and what was going on in Chattanooga and the steps and all this kind of stuff. And by the time he got through, they picked me on the back and said, your car's ready. And he said, well, how about taking me out to Alano Club for a cup of coffee? And I never got to take that drink. I remember another time I had figured out this thing, and I'd never tasted light beer. Had light beer come along, and I figured light beer wouldn't bother me. I could probably get by with light beer, and I was going to try some. Just made my mind up, snap decision right during the meeting. Either right after that meeting, probably I was going to try to have me a couple of light beers and see what happened. And that night when they gave out the chips, there's a guy, Sam, had about the same amount of sobriety I had, picked up a white chip. And I went up after the meeting, and he looked like he'd been run over by a Mack truck. I said, Sam, what happened? He said, Wednesday, a week ago, I started drinking light beer. I said, well, let's scratch plan A, you know. So, you see, what happened to me is I kept coming to meetings and other people kept having the slips that I didn't have to take. And I learned from them, and I've been eternally grateful ever since. I'm sitting in a meeting one night, and I take a little inventory. I look around, I see all the friendly faces, the people that have been good to me, the people that just nice people, and I realized I'd been sober long enough to realize they didn't have an ulterior motive. They really cared. They were genuine. And I thought, you know, you ought to give them the best shot. It's working for them, but it's not going to work for you. But do what they tell you, everything they tell you, exactly when they tell you to do it, and show them it's not going to work. Pay them that much respect. And I started out doing that. Now, if there's anybody here that's tried the conventional way, just try that. And just say, to heck with them. I'll do what they tell me when they tell me to do it. Let's see what happens. Hopefully, you'll be amazed like I was. I wasn't even just started good and got amazed. You see, the first thing I did, I had to listen. When I hadn't listened, I hit that door talking when I got here. And I started listening. And, you know, I believe that if you come... Another thing I believe why it pays to go to meetings, if you come to meetings on a regular basis, you're going to change. Things are going to happen. No matter what your attitude is, it was with me. No matter what my attitude was, I began to change. And little things like meeting Charlie Brown were eerie to me. Why did that happen? And a lot of other things. And I didn't want to tell anybody. And I'd sit at the meeting once I started listening, and I hear people share these things, and they'd say, gosh, isn't it great how God's working in your life? And I began to realize God was working in my life, probably because these things sure were unexplainable that were happening to me. And so really what happened was, you know, you tolerated me, you put up with me, you were patient with me, and you let me sit here and listen to me until I could become teachable. And you shared your God with me, and that gave me hope and strength. And I think that there's nothing great. We can have Bill Wilson chat rooms on the intergroup or www.com sobriety till we die. I don't believe there's anything works as effective as one drunk sharing with another. I think that's Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's what works for me. The drunk sharing with me got... Now, I got with my sponsor then, and he took me by the hand, and we went through the steps, and I learned a lot in the steps. I learned a lot about love and trust, and I learned mostly about me. I didn't know about me, and the steps were great. And I came in here. I didn't believe in prayer, and pretty soon I began to be suspicious that prayer might be the answer to everything. So I started practicing prayer on a regular basis at the suggestion of my sponsor and my group, and things were going well, and I got active in service work, and I had been a DCM, I'd been a state officer, and if you looked at me, I was sponsoring some people, going to five or six meetings a week, and going to retreats and different things. If you looked at me, I probably looked like an AA poster child, but deep down inside, I knew that I didn't have what a lot of other people had. And I went to Jim, and I asked him, I said, Jim, what do you think maybe it is? And he said, well, why don't you get back in the book and find out if you're missing anything? Now, I had been to a couple of Charlie and Joe Big Book studies. I'd been through two or three local Big Book studies, and I knew the book, I thought. But I'd never been back in this book to use it as a textbook to find out something that would work in my life to fix something that I thought I needed. And it was amazing that the different things I read in that book had jumped out at me just like I'd never seen them before. And I can't go through all of them with you, but one of the things that jumped out to me was at the end of chapter 4, it said God would disclose himself if we drew near to him. Now, that made me think. Now, I wanted God to disclose himself. And, you know, I'm a realist. I'm a realist, and I like to see. If I'm going to get results, I think I have to see them. And so I got to thinking of all the places I go, where might I see God's handiwork working? Right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I see it working every meeting I go to just about. So I don't believe I can get much closer to God as I understand him, and I can in an AA meeting. And over the years, every message that I feel like I've received from a higher power has come from another alcoholic. And you know, really when I come to an AA meeting, I'm just checking in to get my messages. And it's a good way to live. I can tell you this, I go out on the road for a couple of weeks and I don't get those messages. And man, I miss it. I start calling home and I try to get to an AA meeting. It doesn't have to be my home group. I can go in an AA meeting in Egypt and I'll get messages from other alcoholics. And I've also been fortunate that I'm on every page in this big book. When I look back in there, it talks about the different types of alcoholics. It talks about the guy that mixed it with milk. It talks about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde going through people's lives like a tornado. I'm on just about every page. So when these people, a lot of people say to me, well, why do you go to these meetings all the time? I say, well, they wrote a book about me. They wrote a book, and I'm on every page, and they get together up there and discuss it. And if they'd written a book about you and they were discussing it, wouldn't you be up there? They seem to understand that. They seem to understand that. So I'm real thankful to the 100 people that they included me in this first 164 pages that's worked in my life. Now, I've had more trauma since I've been sober than I ever had in my life. I'm the kind of alcoholic, the kind of person that couldn't bear death. I just wouldn't face death. And when my mother died, I got drunk. Made an ass of myself. My daddy died, I got drunk. Some things that were almost impossible to mend when I was making my mends. And so I've been sober about 10 years. And my wife of 35 years, my Al-Anon of 10, I took her to the hospital to have her sugar adjusted. And she died in the emergency room from a heart attack very suddenly. And 3 months later, my sponsor died. And 6 months later, my sister died. And I got through every one of those because of the power that I was able to come into these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and put to work in my life. I believe that there's enough power in these rooms to get me through any situation that exists. Whereas if I start drinking, there's not enough liquor distilled to get me through them because I'd probably go insane or have a wet brain before I got through. So the power in these rooms are just amazing. Now, I had noticed the old-timers showed me what to do. Nobody consciously told me, but I saw them when they had trauma in their life, they tripled up on their AA commitments and functions, and I did that. And right after my wife died, I felt so very alone, very lonely. And I didn't realize this. I was the kind of guy that thought I'd just do great because I could cook and pretty good housekeeper, and I didn't think I needed anybody. But I've never felt a loneliness like that in my life. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, I met Donna. And if I hadn't have continued to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, that wouldn't have come about. And we've had a great marriage, as she told you earlier. And she's got her program, I've got my program, but we developed the program together. And every day we meditate and pray together, and we invite God into our marriage to work on a daily basis. And let me tell you, if you try that, most generally along about 9 or 10 o'clock, when you know sometimes when it gets a little bit hot, there's a little disagreement goes on, and you get a little red face, you know. If you think God's in that marriage with you, it kind of keeps me from the type of action and reaction I've had. And on top of that, Donna's developed something at first just drove me insane, but it's a pretty good idea. I'd be just about mad enough to explode, and she'd look at me and she'd say, "I'm Donna, I'm an alcoholic." And what this did was reminded me how we act at meetings, you know. So it's worked well. And I retired 3 years ago. And I've been a workaholic all my life. I didn't know what I was going to do when I retired. I was worrying myself to death. I was worrying myself to death for about 3 weeks. And one morning at 2 o'clock in the morning, I wake up and I'm worried about this thing. And it says, "Foo, why don't you do what you tell everybody else to do?" I rolled out of that bed. I got down on my knees. I said, "God, you handle retirement. I can't take it." And I got back into bed. Now, I wasn't going to retire for another 18 months. Within 35 days, I'm retired due to business and so forth. And it happened in his time and quick, just as soon as I turned it over to him. And today, life is great. I have gotten more involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got free time. I sponsor more people. I have more time to get involved with it. I work at intergroup. And life is good because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found it works in any situation in my life. And, you know, I don't want something that just works when things are going good. I mean, when it gets down mean and green, I like to have a program I can fall back on. And that's what I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it means a great deal to me. I told you about that one son. He had two children, a boy and a girl. And they've never seen me take a drink. One's 21 years old and one's 20. And they've never seen their grandfather take a drink. And to me, that's a miracle. I'm just so thankful for it. My granddaughter once asked me, "So, Papa, is it true you've really been in jail?" You know, and I thought, isn't that great that you can change that much in Alcoholics Anonymous? This little girl came to me when she was about, I don't know, about the sophomore in high school or something, and she asked me if I would come over and speak to her class on alcoholism. And this really made me feel good because they aren't really involved in my program. My son's only been to two meetings, but it's because he's got his life. He's all for Alcoholics Anonymous. He just doesn't come and participate. And sometimes when we have anniversaries at home and I see the large families getting together, I'm a little bit envious and I wonder about it. But I tell you that to show you how pleased I was that she would ask me to come and to be part of her class. And I'm over there in the lobby of the high school and I'm standing there and this little gray-headed principal came up to me. She looked me right in the eye and she said, "Are you Allison's granddaddy?" And I thought, I'm never going to know who I am. But thank God I know what I am. I'm an alcoholic that found a substitute for alcohol. And because of that, today I pray over what I used to drink over. Thank you.